This is Ryan Fitzpatrick, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of the Neil Reynolds Podcast. Hope you're enjoying the series so far. Thank you for your support. If this is your first time listening, please do go back. Check out our episodes with Ryan Fitzpatrick, Bruce Arians, Peter King. And please leave us a rating and a review. It certainly helps as we try and make some noise. So this is the first of the interviews where I've not actually been with a guest in person due to the COVID-19 pandemic. But don't worry, I did get plenty of time with Jacksonville Jaguars head coach Doug Marrone. Now, he looks like a meat and potatoes coach, but he is one of the most fascinating people I've got to know over recent years. I've grown close to him since he's been coaching the Jacksonville Jaguars. He's actually the first professional football player I ever interviewed back in June of 1991 when he was playing in London. Before coaching, Marrone was obviously an offensive lineman. Before that, he grew up in a New York borough where a different sport dominated the landscape. That's where our chat begins. And just a little warning, there is some colorful language in this podcast.
So growing up in the Bronx, I would say that it's baseball was more of a bigger part because obviously, you know, the Yankees are from the Bronx and everybody, you know, talked about baseball. And when you grew up in the Bronx, there's not a lot of grass. So you did have a baseball field, but you didn't have a lot of the football fields. But, you know, football started to become big, you know, during the teenage years, you know, playing around. So you learned how to play basically on concrete with rocks and broken glass that you had to watch out for and things of that nature. So, you know, it was fun. So and then pretty much I always grew up, I always wanted to be a baseball player. And then obviously you look at my size and I was, you know, I kind of outgrew it maybe. And then I just, you know, went to football because I was, you know, it was something at a time because of my size and my great speed. That's what I was good at.
Well, that leads me to my next question. So always offensive line then?
Yeah, I mean, when I was a kid growing up, I always wanted to be a running back and I always wanted to, you know, then I played defense. And then, you know, when I got to the college level, they're like, no, you're an offensive lineman. You know, at first, it's interesting. At first, you get this like little bit of depression, you know, like, what do you mean? I'm not going to touch the football and, you know, and but I'll always say that I will always appreciated that position and being part of it because it's such a great group of guys and it shows you how well you have to work together, really, you know, teamwork part of it with a lot of different personalities. And, you know, if you, you know, eventually I worked myself over to play center, which helped me because then I got my hands back on the football. So I was kind of excited about that.
So it's almost a skill position, almost. I guess mm-hmm. when you grow up the way you did then, I mean, football is a sport that requires toughness anyway, but if you're getting tackled to the concrete, I mean, just generally you're going to have a bit of toughness built into you, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, growing up, I don't know if I had a pair of pants or a sweatsuit that didn't have a hole in it, you know, just from, you know, going down and scraping your knees or anything like that. So there's a toughness about it, you know, just like any sport. I think you can relate to, you know, rugby. I mean, how much appreciation I have for when I was over in London, you know, how tough the rugby players are, you know. You know, it's something that we actually use with our players to show them how to tackle, you know, a lot of times. So, you know, I think that when you look at these sports and, you know, you look at it from when you're a young kid, what's interesting is when you're young, you let your body fly around. You know, I'm sure football players, rugby players will tell you, you know, and then all of a sudden as you start to get bigger and everyone gets stronger, you know, then you have to get the equipment better and then you have to really have the technique right, you know, because you can injure yourself. But I remember as a kid, we were flying around, thrown around, like I said, playing on concrete, and you know, no one was going to the hospital. You know, we had cuts and scrapes and everything, but you know, you just move forward. Now you walk out there, you'll have players say, you know, hey, you know, how come the grass is this high? They should have cut it a little bit lower. And you're like, I just wanted to play on grass. You know what I'm saying? When I was a kid growing up, so you can see how those times have changed.
Yeah, it would have been an absolute luxury. So when did you start to begin? You might have a shot at the NFL. Obviously, you went to college there.
Yeah.
Was it quite early in college, or was it before that even?
I think what happens, and I try to tell this to, you know, when I talk to young groups about, everything starts off as a dream. You know, no matter what you want to do, whether you want to be a pro athlete, whether you want to be a scientist, whether you want to be, an astronaut, whether you want to be, in government, something always starts. And I always think that it starts with a visualization of, you have a dream. And then all of a sudden, during these dreams, you start working towards them, and then you create these smaller goals, for yourself. So, for me, I was like, okay, I want to play in the NFL. All right, what do I got to do? Well, I better be in shape. I better lift, and I better be a good enough high school football player, to have an opportunity to play at the next level. We're able to do that. Go to the next level. If I wasn't thinking about the NFL, I was thinking, okay, I just want to travel. I just want to play. And then I think once I started to play, I played my sophomore year. So I was a 3-year letterman. After my sophomore year, I wanted to be the best player I could. And then as I got closer to my senior year, I started to, create goals of where I wanted to play again. So I think it's important that it wasn't just a dream and I went after playing. I didn't all my whole life think I was going to go play in the NFL. It was my dream. And then slowly I built up to it, and started attaining, the goals that I needed to put me in position to get there.
Doug Marrone was drafted by the Los Angeles Raiders in 1986. Back then, the draft was a very different affair to the glitzy proceedings we see today. And there definitely wasn't the technology for a virtual draft.
Yeah, back then it was, it was like a one-day event and it was long and, I knew it would be later on. I was shocked because of my great speed that I didn't go earlier. But, so obviously I went later and I was excited. I knew they had worked me out and I had a really good workout for them. Mr. Davis, Al Davis, the owner at the time, is a Syracuse grad where I went to college at Syracuse University. And, I was excited. I was a little bit concerned about the reputation, I guess, the Raiders. And there was still a lot of the old Raiders were still on that team. And, guys were winners. And, they played hard and they partied hard. So it was an interesting experience being my first NFL experience.
Yeah, with the Dolphins. So you played most of your NFL games, four or five mm-hmm. NFL games with the Dolphins. Was that due to the strike, coach, or were you already on the roster there?
No, I was already on the roster, and I actually went on strike. So we went on strike, which is really weird. They had the scab team. They had another team, and when we were getting ready to come back, we were going to come back. And I think, and I don't know this for sure, but I think we were going to come back and then, go ahead and go to the stadium on Sunday and just not play, but we were going to come back. And then I think somehow that got out, or maybe it was true, maybe it wasn't, I don't know. But they wound up, when we first came back, they wound up practicing two teams. And I remember my coach going, I got two practice. I'm in double sessions right now because you guys can't get your shit together. Like he was all pissed off because he had to coach, the offensive line with us and then go to the another area to coach the other offensive line just in case. But, we wound up, when we came back, we wound up playing and that was fine. But it was tough because, like I tell people all the time, I lost money that at the time I needed and I'll never be able to make up.
Mm. I was just thinking what the team period might have been like if they'd put the two teams together, given that one lot crossed the picket line and the other lot on strike.
That wasn't a good situation. I felt bad because we had a couple of guys that were on the team that were on the other team, and they were isolated by some of the some of the other veterans that were in the locker room. I have an understanding of it, but I still think it's tough.
So towards the end of your career then, that I didn't realize until I was sort of, I knew you, obviously, we've talked about this many times. You played for the London Monarchs, 1991-92. Still a story that only interests me, not you, but you were the very first professional athlete I ever interviewed. And I still, it's a nice one that we still can connect now and talk about that.
Yeah.
That was at the end of your career, right? I didn't realize that was right at the end of your playing career. So did you kind of know that, or was you looking to use that league for a second chance, or were you already kind of looking at coaching as an option?
I was definitely, I knew that I was older, so I wasn't going to have the same amount of opportunities, and I knew my body started, you know, my body was breaking down. So I looked at it as an experience and really buying time to see, you know, in which direction, you know, I wanted to go into. You know, at first, you know, I really had two decisions I was going to make. I was either going to go to law school and become a lawyer, or, you know, go become a coach. So I kind of started doing the stuff to get myself prepped for law school, you know, get accepted and everything. And then, you know, I was sitting there one day and I'm like, you know what? What do I truly love the most? You know, let's take everything out of it. Let's take what people want me to be, or, you know, do you need to make a lot of money, you know, and everything. And I'm like, it was just me. So I didn't have a family or girlfriend or wife, nothing. So I just said, you know, I'm going to do what I love, because if you do what you love, you have a chance of being really good at it. And I didn't care about, you know, how much money I was making. I didn't care about, you know, what people thought of it. And I started out at the bottom. I started out at a small Division III school and I started coaching.
Doug Marone moved to London to play for the Monarchs in the World League of American Football in 1991. He proved to be one of the best players in the league as the Monarchs won the World Bowl at the old Wembley Stadium. But perhaps more importantly to him, he had an absolute blast and became an honorary Brit.
I love it. I love it. I'm born and raised in the Bronx, born and raised in New York City. And I can tell you that, you know, London's always been my second favorite city. And it's only because I wasn't born there. Like, so for me, what was interesting, so I was brought up in a New York transit system. So I get on the trains, you know, that's how we travel, trains and buses. So all of a sudden we go to London, my first time, and, you know, they got the tube and the maps and the colors. And I'm like, oh my God, this is the greatest transportation system ever. I mean, it's clean, it's fun. I mean, so for me, my love of London was because of my background, and I just fell in love with the city. I fell in love with Hyde Park. I'd go into Harrods, grab some food, go out in Hyde Park, kind of hang out. And then, you know, obviously I like to drink beer, so I'm perfect for, you know what I'm saying, all the pubs. And, you know, the people were so... it's so friendly. I mean, you know, you get in there and you start talking, hey, where are you from? Where, you know, what's going on? And you open up and you know, you drink a pint, you go play some darts, you come back. And every day was like a different adventure for me. So I've got nothing but great admiration of the people in London.
Obviously, we're talking due to the lockdown situation from your home. Does your home have a dartboard?
Does my home have a... No. No, we have ping pong. We have air hockey. No darts. You know why? Because with the aim that some of my children have, I'd have to be fixing the walls. So, no.
And it's not the same, coach. You've got to be in London having a pint while you're playing darts.
There's no doubt.
All right, let's just finish up on your playing career. I just want to finish. So obviously, through the NFL process, you were cut a number of times. Obviously, that mm-hmm. happens to players a lot. That happens. That's a part of this business. I wonder if now, do you have kind of empathy with players? Because you're the one that sits the other side of the desk now. You have to cut players, and you've been in that chair. Can you just take me through that process?
There's no doubt. I think that, you know, one of the things that I was looking at, I'm one of those types of people that, you know, if something negative happens or what other people perceive as being negative, I try to turn it into a positive, meaning that, you know, here I was, like you said, I was a player that was cut many times, and I tried to say, well, you know what, I was on a lot of different teams, I met a lot of people, and that actually has helped me, you know, in my coaching career. And then the worst part of my job, the hardest part of my, the worst thing I do is what you just said. You know, when I have to let someone go, because I've been through that personally many times. And after we make, like when we get on that day where we have to make the final cuts of the team, I always give the coaches and everyone off, not because I want to give everybody off because we've worked so hard. I've got to give everybody off because it takes me, I have a period that I have to go through to kind of just get, or really just push that emotion down. Because I always try to explain it, unless you've gone through it, it's tough. Like, so my experience has been, you know, you've worked your butt off, you've given everything you have, you know, you go to bed that night, you know you're going to wake up the next day. And either two things are going to happen. It's going to be the greatest day in your life. You made an NFL team, and you're going to celebrate, and your family, and everyone's going to be excited for you, and friends. Or you're going to be out of a job, and everyone's going to want to know what happened, and there's really not a clear path of what you're going to do the next day. So there was a lot of emotion, you know, like for me. So when I do that and go through it, it's part of the job that I really, really hate. And hate's probably the proper word for it, too. I mean, I grew up not to use that word, but I hate doing that. I understand it because just think, here are these players that give everything they have. And just because they're not good enough or better than, you know, you're going to have to let them go. So, you know, that's why I try to treat everyone like they're superstars from day one, no matter who they are.
After playing in Europe, Marone began his coaching career at some small colleges, Division III schools. He coached at Cortland State in 1992 and the Coast Guard in 1993. I didn't even realize the Coast Guard had a football program.
It's one of those things, like, I have an appreciation for what I learned, and I can't speak for everyone else, is that, so here I am with all this knowledge that I've gained from playing at Syracuse, and I've been with a lot of different coaches, great coaches, Hall of Fame coaches, and I learned a lot. And so now I have all this knowledge on football, you know, in my mind, and now I've got to go ahead and switch it where I become the teacher. So I made a lot of mistakes, you know, because I was trying to find that, you know, how I was going to talk, my techniques, you know, what I believed in, you know, creating a progression, a foundation of teaching, you know. So it took me a couple of years to really, you know, to really hone in those skills. So I'm thankful for my time at those schools, because if I would have gone from, let's say, you know, playing right to an NFL level, I don't think I would have done a good job and I would have been fired. So for me, working my way up and earning everything as I went along was really an important part of my development as a coach. And I would never have traded it for anything else. And, you know, I never really looked for the next job. I never really had any aspirations of early on in my career of being a head coach or, you know, coaching in the NFL. You know, my job was, hey, listen, I'm going to do the best job for the guys that I'm coaching, you know, and the coaches that are around me. And that's pretty much how I went through everything. Because, you know, you say like the Coast Guard, you know, I look back and that was the greatest place, greatest job from a standpoint of, you know, the cadets have such a rigorous schedule, you know. So football for them is kind of like a relief, you know, from the military type life. So, you know, I have these guys coming in and they're just dying to be there. You know what I mean? I mean, they just love it. And what was interesting is that group of players that I coached, a couple of them, you know, became, you know, captains of ships. Some of them are flying airplanes now. And a lot of them still stay in touch with me, you know, more so than maybe the other teams, you know, that I've been on, because of, you know, that type of relationship, that type of person that goes into those type of academies. So I've always had a great appreciation for the Coast Guard Academy, and probably I have my greatest stories are probably from the Coast Guard Academy.
That's great stuff. So as you work your way along, obviously your first break in the NFL was with the Jets. So obviously you're in New York, born and raised, then you're back with the Jets, then you move on to the Saints. As you're working your way through your coaching stops, do you literally have like a big book where you make notes? Okay, I would do it this way, I would do that. You sometimes hear of coaches and then they go into an interview and they've got this book of, okay, this is my kind of coaching manual. Were you always making notes along the way, or was it mental?
Yeah, no. Yeah, so like when I first became, I was a tight end coach and O-line coach, so you know, I started books on coaching the tight end and O-line where I would make notes and think about where I made mistakes or where I can improve upon. And then I was an O-line coach. I did the same thing. And then I started to say, you know, hey, listen, I think I'd like to be an offensive coordinator. So if I was an offensive coordinator, I had been involved in a lot of different offenses, you know, schematically. And I was like, okay, if I'm a coordinator, what do I believe in? What do I want to teach? So I started to make a book on my philosophy of being an offensive coordinator. And then after that, you know, I was like, okay, I want to be a head coach. And then I started keeping track of, because when you work for someone else and they're telling you what the rules are and everything and what you're going by, you know, you go ahead and enforce those rules that, you know, your boss says wants enforced. But then all of a sudden, when you're the boss, you have to have those rules that you firmly believe are going to help you win and lose, that you have to, you know, it's your decision now. And that's where, you know, I learned a lot about myself, meaning that I never did these books or anything on company time. So it was always on vacation where I'd sit down and, let's say like in college, you know, I coached on a bunch of different college teams and there's a lot of different drug policies. Okay. So I've been on, you know, many college teams and we had all these different drug policies and they're all been great. Well, I had to choose which one I believe is the best, you know, method to go to. And I always tell people, I say, you really learn a lot about yourself when you sit down and you start saying, okay, what do you truly believe in? So, you know, I would do that every summer, you know, and get myself prepared and keep myself ready.
Coach, you did that on vacation. You must have been a blast to be with your poor wife.
No.
Hey, coach's wife.
Well, you know what it is? Hey, listen, I wake up early and everybody else wakes up late. So I would get up early in the morning, spend a couple hours, and then by the time I was done, they were all just waking up. So it didn't cut into, you know what I'm saying, any of their time.
Fair enough. I'll get onto your first head coaching gig at Syracuse in a second, but I just want to talk about with the Saints. Obviously, you were offensive coordinator there. You're with Drew Brees, who, interestingly, at that time was just coming off that shoulder injury, and Miami didn't reportedly want to take the risk on him. So that must have been an interesting time to be working with Drew. And also, you were there the night the Superdome reopened when Steve Gleason blocks that punt. I mean, just take us through that time with the Saints. Must have been a fascinating time, and of course, a stressful and emotional time, I'm sure.
It was. I think, you know, I'll take it right from the beginning. So, you know, we all have seen, you know, the pictures of, you know, that region, you know, from the after the hurricane, you know, Katrina. So we're post Katrina. So Sean Payton, the head coach, he gets hired. He's putting together a staff and we go down there and I take the job. When we first go down there, we stayed at this hotel right across from the airport. And when nightfall came, there weren't any lights on. It looked like it was just weird. It was like, I can't really explain it, but it was just, you know, and then in the daytime when you drive, you know, I'd drive around to kind of look and just to see all the damage. And the first thought to myself was, the pictures that the world has seen does not do any justice to really what happened, you know, down here. So, you know, it was difficult. And then, you know, we wound up training in Jackson, Mississippi, which is probably one of the hottest places I've ever been. So, you know, we wound up training there. And then, you know, Drew was coming off the shoulder. We had a really young football team. We had a really young staff. We really didn't play that well in the preseason, you know, and Drew was still, you know, coming back from the shoulder. And we open up against Cleveland, beat them, go to Green Bay, and we're down 21-7, and we come back and win the game. So now all of a sudden, you know, we've been on the road for 2 weeks. The whole emphasis was trying to rebuild the city, which I give the Saints a lot of credit for. We did a lot of things that were real, not like photo pictures and leaving. You know, we did a lot of work, which I thought was great from Sean Payton and Mickey Loomis to get us involved in it. But then all of a sudden you can feel this building momentum of the city, this rebirth of a region, you know, that kind of focused around this game. You know, this opening of the Superdome where there were so many pictures of, you know, the refugees, you know, staying at the dome and everything that was going on there. And then, you know, all of a sudden they shut the streets down. It was a Monday night game. So starting from like Thursday or Friday, you couldn't get near it and everyone started to party. And you don't really know, but I would say it was probably like a Super Bowl effect. I mean, you had U2 and Green Day were playing, you know. The crowd was unbelievable. And till this day, the loudest moment of my life has been when Steve blocked that punt. I mean, it was deafening, you know what I'm saying, the roar that was going on. And there was really, talked to some coaches from Atlanta, you know, and you know, later on, a couple of years later, they were like, we had no chance that night. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, we just had everything going for us. And I think the greatest lesson I learned was that how a sport could really be part of or helping a rebirth of a region after something that, you know, catastrophic like Katrina happened down there. And that's what I love about sports. You know, we look at it as, hey, it's great. We can relax. We can look at it. We love the competition. We can, you know, we could put a couple pounds down on it, you know what I'm saying, at the corner bookie and things of that nature. But the reality of it is that it can really help uplift, you know, a large area or a large region of a community.
Marone's first head coaching gig came where he played his college football at Syracuse. So he became the head coach there from 2009 to 2012. He was also the Buffalo Bills head coach in the NFL from 2013 to 14 before joining Jacksonville staff. And we talked about the differences between being a coordinator and a head coach. You never really know the enormity of the task of leading a team until you're in the job.
I think it's one of those things that you look at while you're preparing. So let's say you're on the outside, and I think this is true in many professions, not just football. You know, you're sitting there as you know, maybe, you know, in a management position, and you're looking at your boss's chair, and you're like, I can do that. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, you're like, I you know, and then there's times you're like, man, I wonder what he's doing now. He must, you know, what is he doing? What, you know. And you really don't know. And, you know, you get in close and you do a lot of research, or you go to a lot of symposiums where, you know, you have people, you know, explaining what their jobs are. So when you take the job, you really feel like you're ready. And then within the first 3 or 4 days, you realize I'm probably not as ready as I thought. So it's interesting. So like the Syracuse job, I did the same thing. So I said, you know, if I ever got a job again, this is what I would do differently. You know, so that helped me when I went to Buffalo. You know, and then, hey, listen, these are the mistakes I made in Buffalo. If I ever get a job again, this is what I would do differently. And it helped me here in Jacksonville. So I think, you know, at the time where, you know, you can look at yourself and say, you know, I didn't do a very good job here. This is what I can do to make it better. Then you can progress and you can get better as you go through your life. But if you look at, if your ego becomes so strong that you say to yourself, I'm right and everyone's wrong, and it's my, that's never going to work. And you're never going to grow as a person, and you're never going to be a great leader. So I've been unfortunate that I've made a lot of mistakes, but I've been fortunate enough to learn from them.
Absolutely. When you obviously you were in Jacksonville, and then right at the end of that season, you become the interim head coach for 2 games at the end. And I'd love to, and then we'll just finish off about the Jags just generally, but I'd love to know there, in that short period, are you purely trying to keep the team together and let the chips fall where they may in terms of the long term? Or are you already in that 2 week period starting to implement some of the things that you believe in? Because it's such a short time span there, but it did lead to you becoming the head coach full time.
Yeah, normally in those situations, a lot of times, you know, in our profession, you're not going to get the job, you know. So my thought process wasn't on, trying to promote myself or do something that maybe can help me down the road. Haven't done it before, you know, helped. And I thought that, you know, Gus Bradley was the head coach and he hired me. So I was real appreciative of that. And, you know, I was trying to say my thought process was, you know, Gus would want us to finish strong, you know, and we all have this obligation and he's not here to finish it with us. But, you know, I can help that. You know, I can help try to finish this thing in the right way, and we can end the season on a better note, because, you know, we all failed. You know, when a head coach is fired, it's not the head coach by himself. It's all of us, coaches and players. So my whole point was, you know, hey, you know, we have these, whatever it was, 2 weeks together. You know, hey, let's do this thing the right way. Let's you know, we're all part of this. We're all part of the problem. And let's just try to end on a good note.
Marone took full charge of the Jags in 2017, and it turned into a very good season. Jacksonville reached the AFC Championship game and even led the mighty New England Patriots on the road 20-10 early in the fourth quarter. They were just minutes from reaching the Super Bowl before being undone by two late Tom Brady touchdown passes. So does that play on a coach's mind all these years later? Does Doug Marone ever look back?
For me, the way I've handled things is that, you know, you're constantly moving on and going forward. You know, the only time you look back is you look back and say, what can I have done better? You know, what can you have done better? And then you move forward. So I really haven't had, through all the things, I've really never, and I'm not personally really good at celebrating, you know, any type of, you know, success, because I'm always pushing forward. So I never really get a chance to go back and look at, you know, the New Orleans season, the, you know, the Pinstripe Bowls, you know, the bowl games that we went to at Syracuse, you know, the winning season, first winning season at Buffalo, and really the 2017 season. Now, you know, a lot of people bring that up, but I always try to, like, I can never go back and be this person I was, you know, before. So I've got to keep evolving and get better. And I think, you know, everyone wants to hang on to this great moment or whatever moment, you know, wherever you are. And if you're hanging on to that and you're not working towards creating another moment for yourself, I think that gets you in trouble. So for me, I think when I'm done coaching, like when I'm done, when I'm retired, I think I'll be able to go back and really live through and enjoy those moments maybe better than I have, you know, while I continue working.
With the most recent draft, a lot of the pundits are always looking for an immediate grade, looking at it, talking about everyone that Jacksonville drafted loves football and loves the game. And I wonder, just as we finish off, how important chemistry is when you're putting together your team as a head coach. Obviously, speed, yeah, size, you mentioned all, yeah, of those kind of things, but how important as well is chemistry, as the ice cream van goes up my road. Did you hear that?
I love it. Oh, yeah. Hey, let me tell you something. I have this unbelievable... I can't really hear well, but I can hear an ice cream truck from miles away. So it's selective hearing. I would say that... What was the question?
About chemistry. The chemistry.
Yeah, chemistry. I would say that when you're talking about team sports, you know, I think it's the most important thing. And it's tough to, you know, how do you do that? It's tough to put a finger on it, because everyone's so different, you know, how they were brought up and their backgrounds. But when you come into a team, and we talked quite a bit about this with our scouts and our coaches and the players that we brought in, you know, if you bring in people that, you know, obviously we understand that they have to have some type of talent level, right, to be able to perform. But then you want to say, you know, hey, are these individuals, you know, team first oriented people? In other words, what you do for the team is more important than what you do for yourself individually. You know, knowing that if the team succeeds, you'll succeed, you know, and, you know, so that's the type of mentality that you're looking for. You're also looking for players that if one player is getting a lot of attention because of the way he's playing, you know, am I happy for that teammate, or do I become jealous of that teammate? You know, or this person had gotten this endorsement, or this person's picture is on the stadium, or this person when you start getting involved with things like that, your level of play is not going to be the same. It's going to start to diminish. Your locker room is not going to be as strong because now there's going to be lack of communication caused by jealousy or whatever it may be. So you're trying to look for a chemistry of players that respect each other. They don't have to love each other. They respect each other. They can communicate. They're team oriented as far as their goals, and you know, are not, and they can speak freely. You know, you don't want an environment where, you know, no one can talk or collaborate. And then for me as the head coach, I have to have that type of collaboration, and I have to listen, you know, to what those players think will help us win and lose, and work together in combination of, hey, we're in this together. Let's work together and make this right. You know, I'll hold my end of the bargain up, and you guys hold your end of the bargain up. And that doesn't guarantee you victories, but it gives you an opportunity. A lot of times when you take that field, if your locker room's not right, you don't even have a chance to win the game before you step on the field. So I think you're seeing a lot of coaches talk about this, you know, more and more. And I think that people on the outside view it as personalities. You can have many different types of personalities, okay? Personality is not the problem. The problem becomes what goes on in that locker room if those personalities are destructive.
Last one, Coach. You talked about really looking after players when you have to cut them, how you grow a team, looking after an entire team. What have you learned over the years about looking after yourself and looking after your family? So do you have a kind, how do you work that work-life balance? Do you shut out the media? Do you get to spend time away from the game? I'm just want to finish up with a kind of personal look at how you cope with being in that fishbowl of being a head coach in the NFL.
I think a lot of us that have coached and have put so much into it, you know, and I struggle with this. I truly do. I struggle with, you know, how much time that I've cut out for my family. You know, like, you know, the things that I've missed. And I'm fortunate that my wife has been able to, you know, attend all the games and the practices and, you know, things of that nature. Whereas, you know, for myself, it's been difficult, you know. And I try to mitigate, you know what I'm saying, that sense of not being there by, hey, working hard and being able to support my family, you know what I'm saying, from a financial, you know, situation. But I think all of us as coaches, assistant coaches, you know, we all go through that. And I think as I gotten older, I've gotten better at some of that balance, but looking back, it's always going to be something that's always going to, you know, hey, did I do the right thing? You know, you're always going to look back and go, hey, did I do the right thing by putting so much of my time, so much of my energy where I've grown some distance with my family? Because football is hard because you don't have a lot of time off, but you do, they give it to you in one big bunch, meaning like in, you know, June and July. So let's say you have, you know, this 5-week vacation or holiday. Okay. So the first week when you come back and you're implementing yourself back in the family, I really don't know what's going on. They're like, no, the forks don't go there. No, what are you doing? No, we don't do it this way. Hey, stay the hell out. You haven't been involved. Stay away. The second week, now all of a sudden you get how the family's operating. So the second and third week are the best weeks. Right, because now you're truly a family and you enjoy it. It's great, best part of the year. And then the next 2 weeks, you start worrying about the season, and now they're like, "Okay, you need to get out of here." They throw you out.
Thanks very much, then, to Jaguars head coach Doug Marrone. Very generous with his time, and we are now going to turn our attention to the mailbag, bring in producer Gary Hayes, who, Gary, you had to work your magic on that Zoom interview. You're finally earning some of those big bucks.
Working my magic now as well, aren't I?
You are. Well, always. Always working your magic. What have we got in the mailbag?
Well, thanks for having me on again, Neil. So just to start off with, normally it's a question that I give to you, but again, our listeners have been extra with their questions this week. So I just want to start off with Andrew Irving, who asks, you have a dinner table for four. Who would be your NFL-related guests, past and present?
Okay, so am I one of them at the table? So I can only have three?
Well, I guess Andrew's saying there's four, so yeah, you can only have three. Plus three
I want to be at the table. I don't want to be like pouring them wine and stuff. So I'm going to go, our good friend from episode one, Ryan Fitzpatrick. I think this is a complete all-rounder at the dinner table. So Fitz would be able to talk about the NFL, all the ins and outs of all the different places he's played, quarterback, playing for eight different teams. He's the son of a rocket scientist, so he's going to be intelligent, coming from Harvard. He's going to have any kind of conversation in hand. And the man likes to stick baby carrots and other food items into his beard. So I think he's going to cover off all the bases. So Fitz is guest number one. Guest number two is going to be Michael Irvin, the Super Bowl winning wide receiver for the Dallas Cowboys. Absolute bundle of energy, never stops talking. Absolutely hilarious. I was on the road with him for the NFL UK live tours last year, about April last year, and he is the funniest man. I mean, he's just a bundle of energy. You never know what he's going to say. You never know what he's going to do. So I think he'd be fun at the dinner table. So that's Fitz, Michael Irvin, and then I'm going to have Bill Belichick, because I think Bill is secretly funny and secretly... Wow, yeah, it's a real, really, really dark, well-kept secret. But I think he would be. I think in a relaxed atmosphere, get a couple of glasses of wine in him. Fitz has relaxed him with a bit of sort of putting stuff in his beard. I think Bill Belichick would have some great stories to tell. But this dinner would have to be after he's finished in the NFL, because he's so guarded. He just wouldn't trust us at all. So this is going to have to take place after Bill Belichick retires.
And getting to bring his dog along.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I liked his dog in the draft. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so it's moving on to Christopher Lawton. This is a bit of a tongue twister, so I'll try my best.
Good luck.
Whose off-field personality diverged the most from their on-field persona of the people you have interviewed?
The most obvious one that comes to mind, it might be a bit of a surprise, but only because he's such a beast on the field, but it's Ndamukong Suh. I've interviewed him a number of times now. I interviewed him for the first time in London. He was taking part in the Gumball Rally, and he's a big car enthusiast, and he loves his Premier League soccer as well. So he was over in London, and it was kind of at the height of when Sue was the bad boy of the NFL, considered the dirtiest player in the NFL. And I was a little bit intimidated walking in to interview him. I thought, hey, how much can I ask him? How much am I going to upset him? I don't want to see the kind of nasty glare in his eyes. Could not have been a nicer person. And I've worked with him on Super Bowl coverage on Sky. I've interviewed him probably another four or five, six times since that first meeting. And he said he's a different person. As soon as he crosses that white line, he's going to play to the whistle and then probably just a little bit beyond it as well. So he recognizes that he's considered a dirty player. It frustrates him because he doesn't think he is. He just thinks he's an intense player. But he's the kind of biggest difference from, especially when he was in that period with Detroit and there was a game he got ejected from for stamping on an offensive lineman's head. He's so different from that. Literally, the white line defines him. You know, he crosses it and he's a different person. If you're just interviewing him and chatting with him, nicest guy in the world.
You mentioned Bill Belichick there about you wanting him at your dinner table. But if you're in the pub, which head coach in the NFL are you having a beer with? And that's from Johnny Ridd.
Johnny Ridd. If it's only one guy, I'm going with Bruce Arians. You know, again, our guest, I'm loyal to the pod, you see. I'm sticking to our guest from episode two, because I think if you're going to properly go for it and have a night out, You want a little element of not quite sure what's going to happen, not quite sure where you're going to end up, and not quite sure what time the evening or the morning is going to end. And I think Bruce Arians, even now, the advanced stages of his NFL career, I think he ticks every box.
I think you never quite know where you're going to end up with Bruce Arians. So absolutely, he's the one I'm going for a beer with. I've got some honourable mentions, though. I think I'd quite like to go for a beer with John Gruden. I think that'd be pretty fun. Sean Payton as well. I know some people think he's a bit prickly. I've had nothing but positive experiences with him. Now, these other ones, I don't think you could have a beer with them. So Sean McVay from the Rams, I think he'd be getting ID checked the whole time. He looks like he's about 15 years old. But the two times I've interviewed Sean McVay, I've had to interview him at 6:30 in the morning. So I'm going for a coffee with Sean McVay for certain.
Or a vodka Red Bull to keep your energy up.
Yeah, exactly. Pete Carroll from the Seahawks. I'd like to sit on a boat. They've got a lake by the side of their practice field in Seattle. So I think I'd like to sit on a boat with Pete Carroll and have a nice glass of wine. And then I have some barbecue food with Andy Reid of the Chiefs, because I think he would be quite generous in the portions that were ordered. So there's a whole kind of different vibe there with each of those coaches. But if it's just a beer and it's just one night out, it's Bruce Arians.
And, of course, Doug Marrone. Just for the sake of on this Marrone, week's
he
likes,
well, he'd have a beer and a game of darts, as we discovered. So, yeah, and he's a very kind of, you could tell he was an offensive lineman, because I've interviewed Doug for a number of times, and when he talks about London, he always talks about beer, darts, and he didn't actually bring it up in this interview, but he always talks about shepherd's pie as well. He's obsessed with beer, darts, and shepherd's pie. Gotta love it. You gotta love it.
Honorary Brit. No. So we're running out of time, Neil. So just looking ahead to our next episode, who we got on?
Yep. So we're back on May the 28th. And we're going to pencil in, because I'm always trying. I'm always working, you see, to get different guests and move things around. But as of right now, then we're going to be with our good friend, my good friend, Brian Baldinger. Played for many years as an offensive lineman in the NFL and has really worked his way to the top of the broadcasting tree in America. He works now for NFL Network. He was a commentator for Fox. Myself and Baldy met in NFL Europe in 1998, so we go back many, many years. He's got some great stories to tell, and he'll share all of those with us on episode 5.
And he's a Bruce Springsteen fan, so he gets my vote. So do you want to close off the show now?
I would. I just want to say, again, huge thank you to everyone who's listening to this podcast. We do read all of your comments and reviews. Well, only if they're positive, but we read those ones for sure. Just loving the support. Glad that it seems to be hitting the mark with you guys. Tell your friends. Tell your friends all about it, and we'll see you next time. This episode was hosted by myself, Neil Reynolds. Our producer is Gary Hayes, while Matt Alabaster is responsible for all of our artwork. Taylor Hayes mixed this episode and also composed our theme music. Special thanks to junior producer Henry Smith and everyone else involved in helping us put this episode together. The Neil Reynolds Podcast is a Highway 61 production for the Reynolds Podcast Network.